Shall we begin?
Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi.
Continuing in chapter 2, we'll begin our recitation here in verse 9. Repeat after me.
Sanjayo vacha, eva muktva hrishikesham,
guda kesha parantapa,
nayotsya yati govindam,
Uktva tushnim babhuvaha.
Excuse me.
Son. There we go. Tamu vacha hrishikeshaha.
Tamu vacha hrishikeshaha.
Rahasam niva bharata.
Senayorhubhayormadhye
Vishidantamidam vachaha Shri Bhagavanu vacha Ashochyanan vashochyastvam Prajnavadam shabhashase Gathasunagathasunshcha Nanushochanti panditaha Natvevaham jatu nasam Natvam neme janadhipaha Nachaiva nabhavishyamaha Sarve vayamatah param Dehi nosmin yatha dehe Haumaram yauvanam jara Tatha dehantara praptir Dhirastatra namuhyati Matra sparshastu kaunteya Shitoshna sukha dukkadaha Agamapayino nityas Antitikshasva bharata Yam hi na vyathayantyete Purusham purusharshabha Samadukkasukham dhiram Somratatvaya kalpate Nasato vidyate bhavo Na bhavo vidyate sataha Ubhayor api drishtontas Tvanayos tattva darshibihi Avinashitu tadvidhi Yena sarvamidam datam Vinasham avyayasyasya Nakaschit kartu marhati Anan antavantahi me deha Nityasyokta sharirinaha Anashino prameyasya Tasmad yudhyasva bharata.
In our previous class, we just began Sri Krishna's Upadesha, his spiritual teachings to Arjuna to come. You remember that the entire chapter 1 and the beginning verses of chapter 2 were really the story of the Mahabharata, which is the context or the setup for the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. So really speaking, it's not until chapter 2, verse 11, that the Upadesha, Sri Krishna's spiritual teaching to Arjuna, begins. And it began with that very startling statement to Arjuna, Ashochyan anvashochyastvam. Arjuna, you are grieving for that, for those who do not deserve your grief. Now, it's a very, when you think about it, it's a very peculiar thing to say to Arjuna, who, after all, is grieving in advance, considering the death of his beloved family members that's about to take place on the battlefield. Remember, this dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna takes place on the first of the 18 days of battle that took place. The Mahabharata Yuddha, that battle, 18-day battle, this dialogue taking place on the first morning of that battle. And Arjuna has a pretty good sense of what's about to ensue on that battlefield. It's going to be horrible. He's grieving, and Sri Krishna says, hey, you're grieving for those who do not deserve your grief. And this is looking at the situation at a very different level. A verse or two before that, Sanjaya said that Sri Krishna was prahasan eva. Sri Krishna was as though laughing. And to summarize a lot of our previous class, Sri Krishna obviously has a different perspective on what's happening as opposed to Arjuna. Arjuna's perspective has caused him to be overcome by anxiety and sadness and anticipation of the death of his beloved family members. Sri Krishna is clear-minded, clear-headed, completely at peace, even in that horribly difficult situation. Where we pick up the thread this morning is to understand what is it about Sri Krishna's perspective that allows him to be at peace in that situation, and what is it that Arjuna can acquire to help him regain the peace that he had before. And just to set the context very clearly, remember, Arjuna is about to enter into the most challenging and difficult situation of his life. Should he go into that situation being overcome by his emotions? Or should he enter into that situation being clear-headed, being focused, and being at peace? Obviously, the message for us all, and Arjuna's situation is a metaphor for the difficulties we all face at life. When we encounter those really difficult, challenging situations in our lives, we've been through many already. When you think about the decades that we've lived through already, how many really nasty, difficult situations we've been through. I don't want to sound too grim, but in the future, if we want to be mature adults about this, we better be ready to admit that the challenges ahead of us are more significant than the challenges we've already lived through. True? Let's admit it. That we've been through big challenges. Excellent. We dealt with them pretty well. Wonderful. The challenges ahead are much more. We better be ready for them. Fortunately, these teachings are absolutely powerful enough to empower us to deal with those situations. Let's pick up the thread here in verse 13, where Sri Krishna says,
Dehi nosmin yatha dehe,
Dehi nosmin yatha dehe,
Kaumaram yauvanam jara,
Kaumaram
tatha dehantara praptir.
Dhirastatra
namuhyati. Dhiraha tatra namuhyati. Dhira here, dhi means buddhi, intellect. Dhira, those who are wise. Tatra, in this situation, dhiraha, those who are truly wise, namuhyati, they don't get confused. They're not overwhelmed by their emotions. Why? And Sri Krishna begins to teach here. He says, dehinaha asmin yata, yata, just as. Asmin, in this, dehinaha, in this, dehinaha, dehi is one who possesses a deha. We better get some terminology here. Deha, this is deha, physical body. And the word deha has an interesting etymology, derivation. Deha, body, is derived from the root, the dhatu, dah, to burn. Deha is often translated as dahana yogya, that which is fit to be burnt. What is it a reference to? And the obvious reference is when we're done using these bodies and we travel on, the bodies are left behind, what to do? Burn them. So that which is eventually burnt is the deha, the physical body. Dehi is one that possesses a body. This is a very fundamental distinction that we don't, unless you are a Vedantin, a spiritual seeker, you don't think much about the difference between deha and dehi, the body and the possessor of a body. Are you a body or are you the possessor of the body? What a fundamental distinction. You know, and this is a launching point for a lot of pure Vedanta. And what comes right here in the beginning of chapter 2 is pure Vedanta. The word Vedanta, you know, refers to the spiritual teachings that comes from the ancient rishis, comes at the end of the Vedas and the Upanishads, so we call it Vedanta. And what they taught, and a teaching that's familiar to some extent to you all, is you're not this body. You are the possessor of the body or the indweller of that body. The term dehi, in plural dehinaha, for those who possess bodies. Consider the magnitude of our confusion. You all say, Swamiji, you're thinking right now, Swamiji, we know we possess a body. We all know we're not bodies. Why are you telling us what we already know? You may be thinking this. Well, it's a peculiar kind of knowledge. It's like a half knowledge. You say that, Swamiji, if you feel that you've been through these teachings before and it's quite clear to you that the body is something you possess, the body is not who you are, you may understand that conceptually or intellectually, but it looks like in our conventional thinking, it hasn't gone in. This is, it's weird. It's a half knowledge. Look at this. If the body is truly something you possess, if it's truly a vehicle in which you abide, a vehicle, that's a nice metaphor. Deha is a vehicle. And just like your automobile is a vehicle, this morning you got into your car, you drove here to the ashram, later you'll drive home. In the same way, you got into these vehicles however long ago, several decades ago, at the date of your true birthday. Not in American English, we say, when is your birthday? And technically speaking, your birthday is the date of your birth. The other dates that we celebrate every year are actually the anniversary. So your actual birthday is the day in which you got into this vehicle. And so for however many years, you're using this vehicle, traveling around in this vehicle, parking it from time to time. What is it? In the metaphor, what does it mean when you park your vehicle? I suppose that's like, I didn't say getting rid of it, parking it. So parking it would be like at night when you're sleeping, you park your body in the bed. Nice. And, you're just as your car occasionally needs maintenance. These certainly need maintenance. You take your car to the auto shop. You take these to the doctor, to the hospital, whatever, for maintenance. And we also know that when your car has 200,000 miles on it and it's every other week it's got a new problem and you're taking it to the auto shop for repairs, it's going to be such a nuisance. You can't wait to get rid of that old junky car and get a new car. The day will come when we can't wait to get rid of these bodies because they will become such an incredible nuisance at some point. It'll be so clear that keeping them going is far more trouble than it's worth, and we will happily let go of these vehicles knowing that something else will come. Excellent metaphor. And a metaphor that's, maybe the car metaphor may not be familiar, but the idea of looking at our physical bodies as a vehicle is a concept that's absolutely clear to all of you, I'm sure, before coming here to these classes. But again, it only seems to be a half knowledge. We understand it conceptually or intellectually, but it hasn't really gone in. Here's why. If you drive around in a 1999 Toyota, suppose you're driving around a 1999 Toyota, you meet someone, would you identify yourself as hello, I am so-and-so, I am a 1999 Toyota? who would say such a thing? But isn't that exactly what we do? If I were to say, so 1999 Toyota is like saying, I am a 1953 model white male. Isn't it the equivalent? 1999 Toyota, 1953 male. Now, of course, 1953, that this body was born in 1953 is a fact. That this body is a male body is a fact. But notice when we identify ourselves, as we commonly do, in terms of our age and gender, aren't we really referring to the vehicle? And tell me, isn't your self-concept, your image, your understanding of who you are, isn't your age and gender a major part of our self-identity, self-identification? We see ourselves. Every morning you stand in front of the mirror and see that your vehicle's getting a little older. Is that what you say? So, oh, look, my vehicle's getting older. Look, my body is getting older. I am getting older. This really reveals that we don't understand. It's a concept. It's an idea. You don't understand. If this is a vehicle like that 1999 Toyota, then to say I am a male born in 1953 is as idiotic as saying I am a 1999 Toyota. It's that silly. But we make that mistake every single day. So it's clear it hasn't really gone in. We say those words a little bit like there's a story in traditional circles in India where someone went to visit a very great scholar who lived in South India and wasn't sure where this great scholar lived. There were many huts in the jungle, and wasn't sure where this particular scholar lived. Outside the huts are all the trees, and in some of the trees were these green parrots that you see all over India. And one of these green parrots was chirping, actually was pronouncing some Sanskrit statements. He went on saying, swatah pramanam, swatah pramanam. Some Sanskrit words. Pretty peculiar to hear a parrot reciting Sanskrit words and a philosophical statement at that. Well, the person knew that wherever the parrots were, that was the house. The parrots were outside of this particular hut. Obviously, that's where the scholar lived. We're a little bit like those parrots, aren't we? If we go on reciting things that sound very wise, oh, I'm not this body, oh, I'm not this mind, I am Satchidananda. You can train a parrot to say, I am Satchidananda. Is that parrot enlightened? When we say conventionally that I am not my body, I am not my mind, it doesn't have much more meaning generally than it has for that parrot. So let's, as we proceed with these teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, let's admit that we don't really get it. We get it conceptually. You get it. The idea is clear, but it hasn't really gone in. And this is important. Let's just pause and reflect. One of the mistakes that we sometimes make in any scriptural study, especially in study of Bhagavad Gita, is that you're reading something, you're hearing something, and oftentimes the sense is, yeah, I know that. I've heard this before. Tattvamasi, I've heard that long ago. And our tendency then is, if you're reading the book, tendency is, okay, I know that, and you flip the page. Well, the moment you flip the page, you've lost an opportunity to reflect and really get something new. That's one great advantage of attending a class on Bhagavad Gita. You don't get to flip the page. I do. This is the key. Now, which means, we're not going to, especially on verses, some of these verses, we're not going to race through these verses, even though the meaning is pretty simple and pretty obvious. We're going to take our time because it has to go in. Until you can, let's paint a real vivid image. Until when you look in the mirror, when it's just as clear as it is when you look in your garage. You look in the garage, you see that 1999 Toyota. You look in the mirror, you see that whatever your make and model happens to be. Oh, just for fun, we all of the characteristics of the models, some are luxury models and some are pretty plain, right? Some have a really fancy paint job and some have very simple. Some are made in Japan, some are made in India, some are made in the U.S. You can take this metaphor as far as you want. But it hasn't gone in until looking in the mirror is like looking in your garage. When you can see your own body with the same objectivity. When you look in a garage and you see your car has a flat tire, you say, oh, I got to fix the flat tire. When you can look in the mirror and see some problem with your physical body and respond just as objectively, the car has a flat tire. Would you say, I have a flat tire? The car has a flat tire. Actually, it's interesting, the language. If you're driving someplace and you get a flat tire and you call someone to let them know, you say, I'm sorry, I'm going to be late. I have a flat tire. We are so confused. It's amazing. The car has a flat tire. Your body has some illness. Let's be clear about what's going on. And in the coming verses, we're not going to focus on that right now because it's a major topic at the beginning of chapter 2. So we're going to proceed a little bit now, but we're going to come right back, probably towards the end of this class, we're going to come right back to this point, how to really discover personally and experientially that you are independent of this body. We must undertake that kind of inquiry. What we're engaged in, we may have discussed this before, just in case we haven't, what we're engaged in is not study of the Bhagavad Gita. And a very silly way of putting it, and I think I made this comment in a prior class, and that is, if you're coming here on Saturday mornings to study the Bhagavad Gita, you're wasting your time. And I'm not being facetious. I'm being provocative, but not facetious. Why? The subject matter that we're studying is not a text, is not a scripture. What is the subject matter we're actually studying? Atma, your true nature. But look at the difference. If your orientation is to study Bhagavad Gita, you're missing the whole thing. We're coming here not to study a text. We're coming here to understand who we are, to discover that inner divinity, that inner truth. Therefore, let's correct our orientation. We want to proceed looking at these teachings not in a third-person manner, but in a first-person manner. Remember your grammar classes? Third-person was used for he, she, or it. Second-person was you. First-person is I, we. Oftentimes, we read scripture with this third-person orientation, and you read in that text, you are not the body. Of course, the text says you are not the body, and you think, yes, someone is not the body. or the generic we are not our bodies. Then it goes on to say that Atma is Satchidananda, and then in your brain it registers, yes, something called Atma is Satchidananda. This is third person listening. This is a waste of time. It maybe if you're in a college classroom and studying this, maybe you can get a good grade by getting all that information. That's clearly not our orientation. To listen in the first person is to constantly reflect on ourselves and our own experience. So when the text says that you possess a body, our response should not be, yeah, I know that. Our response should be, is it true in terms of my experience that I possess a body and I'm independent of the body? And then if I find, wait a minute, I seem to be something more than the possessor of this body. I have sensation in this body. I have a very strong connection to this body, much stronger than my possession, my connection to my car. And this launches us into a process of self-inquiry. And that would be a better way of understanding this process. We come together not to study Bhagavad Gita. We come together to engage ourselves in a process of self-inquiry, atma-vichara. Atma-vichara is a term frequently used in this tradition to describe that journey of discovery. We turn our attention within for the sake of discovering what we're not, the physical body, etc., and discovering who we are, that consciousness within, that inner divinity. This is the orientation then. First person, atma-vichara, self-inquiry. Okay. So, dehinaha, asmin, dehe. Dehinaha, for an embodied person, yata, just as, asmin, dehe, with reference to this body, asmin, dehe. With reference to this body, there is kaumaram, childhood, yauvanam, youth, jara, old age, illness, etc. We see that these bodies undergo these stages of growth and aging and finally decay. Isn't it just like your car? When you first think of that brand new car, how wonderful that is. When you take that new car home for the first time, just like when, of course, we don't have any memory of when we were taken home by our mother and father for the first time and how delighted they must have been by their new child. So you think of your car when it was brand new. Think of your car how it is today, not exactly brand new anymore. And think of how your car is going to be in 10 years from now if you keep it that long. This is a natural process for a car. By the way, should one argue, oh, we should just keep the car in a garage and then it won't get so old? Suppose someone thinks, oh, we just will protect the car, we won't drive it much. Well, doesn't it defeat the purpose of having a car? If it just sits in a garage unused. So the car is meant to be driven and driven all over the places as long as you can, as many miles as you can. Why not? In the same way, we need not be overly protective about these bodies. They're going to age. And being a little too timid and overprotective of our bodies then will prevent us from living a very full and complete life. Just like trying to keep that car in a garage, it's silly. Bodies undergo these stages of kaumaram, childhood, yauvanam, youth, and jara, old age. Tata, in the same way, deha antara praptihi. In the same way, there will be the prapti, gaining. Gaining what? Antara, a different what? Deha, body. So just as yatha, just as for the dehi, for the owner of the body, for the possessor of the body, for the indweller of the body, for that person, there will definitely be, with reference to this body, there will definitely be childhood, youth, and old age. And in the same way, there's going to be another body after this one passes. It's just like your car. Do you think the car you're driving today is the last car you're ever going to drive? Not likely. Eventually that car will get old, you'll get rid of it, you'll take another car. So in the same way, this body will eventually be retired when it's no longer valuable. Tatra here, in this matter, dhiraha, wise ones, nah mukhyati, are not confused. Now, we're going to move on, but let's be clear, we're not done with this topic. So we're just beginning this topic. We really want to investigate in a very personal and experiential way how this body is just a vehicle, no more, no less. When we call the body a vehicle, are we devaluing it? I don't think so. Your car is just a vehicle. It's not you. Does it mean you're going to just let it get crashed into and let it get broken and dented and non-functional? No. You're going to take care of your car for very pragmatic reasons. So by saying that the body is just a vehicle, we're not devaluing it. What we're after, and my guru, Puja Swami Dayananda, put so much emphasis on this word, said what we're after is objectivity. Car is a car, no more, no less. A body is a body, no more, no less. The problems of the car belong to the car. We fix them the best we can. The problems of the body belong to the body. We fix them the best we can. This is objectivity. We'll see much more about this in several more verses, but let's proceed for now. So Sri Krishna, having just begun to introduce these very profound teachings of how your true nature is independent of the body, mind, and senses. Therefore, Arjuna is grieving. How can Sri Krishna say that you're grieving after those who don't deserve your grief? Arjuna is looking right across into the eyes of Bhishma and Drona. Sri Krishna says, they don't deserve your grief. How is Arjuna to understand this? Well, tell me, Arjuna loves Bhishma and Drona. Fact. Does he love their bodies? Huh? That's a peculiar way of putting it. But it's true. Arjuna loves who they are, the essence of who they are. Notice it's only their bodies that are going to fall on the battlefield. And certainly Bhishma's body will, on the bed of arrows, will perish on the battlefield. Drona similarly will perish on the battlefield. But their bodies that are going to perish. Let's proceed.
Matra sparshastu kaunteya. Shitoshna sukha dukha daha. Agamapaino nityas. Antitikshasva bharata.
So, having given Arjuna a little bit of understanding, now in this verse and the following verse, Sri Krishna is going to attempt to shift Arjuna's perspective. One of the, before we see the meaning of this verse, one of our mistakes, common mistake when we encounter crises in life, difficulties. A common problem is we get so focused on the problem of the moment, we lose perspective. We've all been there. In a moment of crisis, you're probably not thinking 10 years from now, 20 years from now. You're thinking about how to handle today, how to get through this day, how to get through tomorrow, how to get through this week. You're very much focused on the problems of the moment. That perhaps is natural, but it might not be entirely helpful. Because by focusing so narrowly on the problems of the moment, we begin to lose perspective. We begin to lose what we nicely call in American English, the big picture. And if you lose the big picture, you get a distorted view of what's really going on. The big picture is a quick story to illustrate that of a couple visiting a famous museum, standing in front of one of these very famous old paintings. And suppose he, and allow me to pick on engineers. I'm an ex-engineer myself, so I have a license to pick on them. He, being an engineer, stands about 2 inches away from this painting, looking at it very intently. And he says, look at this paint. It's got all these little cracks in the paint. And aren't they taking care of this painting properly? Isn't there any process of conservation? How did those cracks take place? And he goes on analyzing all of these cracks on the painting, standing 2 inches away from this incredible work of art. What's wrong? To use the metaphor, he's not getting the whole picture, the big picture. To get the big picture, you have to stand back. Now, what's interesting is she's standing back from the picture. She sees not only the whole thing, but she feels the emotion that the artist wanted to convey through that beautiful painting. What is the purpose of a painting? After all, the artist has the artist wants to convey something to you, often an emotion. And the artist works very hard to create this painting to convey this emotion to you. Can you get the emotion with your nose 2 inches away from the picture? No way. Further, This is an incredible work of art. With your nose 2 inches away, all you can see are these little cracks. That is, all you see are the defects. Naturally, when you're 2 inches away, you're only going to see the defects. Only when you stand back will you get the whole picture. This is a problem most of us have in a time of difficulty. We get so focused on the problems of the moment, we lose the bigger picture. We lose sight of how this, it's a terrible event, no doubt, but in a larger scope of our lives, maybe it's not such a big deal. These cracks in the painting, they're a fact. The painting is cracked. But do the cracks deny the painting the power to convey this beautiful emotion? Even with the cracks, the picture conveys its emotion quite clearly. The cracks in the picture represent the problems in our lives. The presence of the cracks in the picture, do they destroy the beauty of that painting? Absolutely not. The painting maintains its beauty in spite of the cracks. In the same way, our lives contain many problems, difficulties, issues, just like those cracks. And those cracks do not prevent us from having wonderful lives, meaningful lives, joyful lives, unless we stand 2 inches away. That is, unless we focus on our problems to such an extent that we fail to see the bigger picture of our lives. So in this verse and the next verse, Sri Krishna wants to elevate Arjuna's perspective to help Arjuna now get that big picture, to see that this terrible battle is only going to last 18 days. 18 horrible days, but 18 days that finally come to an end. And so here, Sri Krishna begins to help Arjuna see that. He says, Kaunteya, O son of Kunti, O Arjuna, he says, at the very end, Tan titikshasva Bharata. Bharata, O greatest of India, Tan titikshasva, at the very end. Tan, these. Titikshasva, these you must endure. These you can endure. Or a better word might be accommodate. There's a difference between enduring something and accommodating something. Enduring something sounds like it's something really miserable that you have to put up with. Accommodate means something that you can handle. What is it that you can handle? He says, all of these, let's see, where shall we begin? I'll start at the beginning. Matra sparshahatu. This sparsha, sparsha literally means touch in a broader sense, experience. Experience of matra, experience of things that can be experienced, things that can be measured quite literally, referring to the world of experience. Matra sparsha, it's a little poetic, by the way. I have to warn you, if you get very literal, you know, the sparsha of matra literally means touching what can be measured. Huh? It means experience of the world. Then you wonder, well, why doesn't he just say experience of the world? Why does he say touching what can be measured? And then you have to remember, this is poetry. Poetry uses words to have a particular kind of effect. And sometimes the words used are a little suggestive or obscure. That's poetry. I remember years ago studying some kavya of Kalidasa. And Kalidasa, the greatest poet in the history of the world, perhaps, certainly in India's history. And I remember my frustration when it became apparent that wherever a simple expression would do, Kalidasa would go and find the most obscure way of describing it possible, so that you couldn't just read a verse, you have to sit on a verse for 10 minutes before you could really digest the meaning, before you can move on to the next verse. So this is kavya, this is poetry. Be ready for them. So matra sparshaha, experience of worldly things, which is shita, ushna, sukha, dukkha, daha. Things which are the daha affix, that which gives. Your worldly experience give. What do they give? Shita and ushna. Experience of cold and heat. Experience of sukha and dukkha. Experience of happiness and pain, suffering. So our worldly experiences naturally give rise to experiences like cold and heat and pleasure and pain. This is what worldly experiences are about. And he says they are agama apayanaha. They have agama and apaya. Agama, coming. Apaya, going away. They are anitya, the next word. Impermanent, transient. This is where the bigger picture is conveyed. Worldly experiences go on changing. Agama, apaya. Things come, things go. Every worldly experience is anitya, transient, temporary, always changing. Big picture is this. When we are in a really miserable situation, let's be more specific, not just miserable, miserable situation, when you are depressed. What's the difference between being sad and being depressed? These words are not synonyms. Sad, we know very well. Depressed, one way of describing depressed is, I am sad, and I will always be sad. That second part, that conclusion, that I am going to continue being sad, my life is sad, everything is sad, and it's not going to change, this is clearly depression, not just sadness. Depression always involves a loss of hope. That is, the miserable condition that exists right now is going to continue permanently. Tell me, is that possible? Is it possible? Well, actually, what we're really talking about is emotions, that emotion of sadness. Is it possible to have an unchanging emotion? Can you imagine someone who has unchanging happiness? They walk around with a big grin on their face all day long, no matter what's happening. Somebody comes with some really bad news, oh, this dear friend just passed away, and this person has this big smile on his face because he has this one unchanging emotion of happiness. Silly. Emotions go on changing. How often do the emotions go on changing? My gosh. In a single day, how many changes of your emotions? Somebody said the emotions go on changing like the weather. Well, no, more. here in New Jersey, the weather changes significantly more, from day to day. Well, I have to share with you a funny observation. Someone who had just come from India asked me once, why are you Americans so obsessed with weather? This is the comment. Why are everyone in this country, you're all obsessed with weather? What's the big deal? You have half-hour weather program. You have what? Weather channel. 24/7. Why are you Americans so obsessed with weather? And of course, you've all come to understand by now. When you live in India, whatever is the weather today, it's the same tomorrow. If it's hot today, it's hot tomorrow. If it's raining today, it's raining tomorrow. Whatever is the weather today, that tells you what the weather is tomorrow. Is that true here? No. Okay. Weather here changes rapidly, day to day, and sometimes in the course of a day, there'll be several different kinds of weather. Is it true that your emotions change like the weather? I'd suggest that your emotions change much more rapidly than the weather. Much more. In a given day, you might have two or three different kinds of weather. Would you say you have two or three different emotions in the course of a day? How rapidly our emotions change. How volatile our emotions are. Now, look at the significance of this. Somebody who feels really sad, incredibly sad, because they're in a horribly sad situation, and feeling that sadness, what is the conclusion? My life is gone. Nothing but sadness. Sad, sad, and more sad. I'm always going to feel sad forever and ever. What leads us to that kind of wrong conclusion? We lose sight of this very fundamental principle that every experience in life is anitya, constantly changing. There is always agama, arriving, and apaya, leaving. Whatever it is today, it goes on changing. Whatever is the weather today, it'll be different tomorrow. Whatever is your weather up here in your... Oh, just for fun, can you imagine, just like we have weather forecasts, how about a forecast of your emotions? Suppose you can turn on some kind of TV channel and get the forecast for today. Is happiness with occasional sadness, maybe a few showers of tears. But that's what we're doing, is we're describing the reality, the human reality, and that is emotions go on changing rapidly. How can we come to the conclusion that I'm always going to be sad? It's absolutely silly. And to make this even, this actually touches on a very important reflection. A lot of the emotional changes we undergo are not even caused by situations. Obviously, situations affect us and will affect our emotions. As the situations go on changing, our emotions go on changing. That's all very clear. Sometimes our emotions are what they are, completely unrelated to a situation. Did you ever wake up in the morning feeling really down? For no reason? Yeah. What's going on? Beautiful sunny morning, no particular problems in your life. You crawl out of bed just feeling down. What's going on? Scientists have a word for it. They're called hormones and neurotransmitters. Chemicals. Chemicals circulating in your brain that affects how you feel emotionally. It happens. A lot. Chances are, it happens to us more than we know, more than we acknowledge. Our emotional ups and downs, no doubt, are partially due to situations in our lives, without doubt. But I can't help but feel that a lot of our emotional ups and downs and turmoil is due to chemicals in our brains, which we have virtually no control over, just like the weather. So it might be helpful if we had, and I'm sure 50 years from now, 100 years from now, it'll be possible. Just as you turn on the TV today and you find out that it's going to be rainy today, so bring an umbrella, the day will come when you'll be able to get a forecast for the chemicals in your brain, the neurotransmitters and hormones that affect our brain so much, and having got that forecast, maybe a forecast for some insufficient serotonin, which means you're going to feel a little down. And so if you get that kind of forecast, the day will come when you just say, okay, and then you take some pill and then it goes away. The day will come. The point is, is it possible that we sometimes take our transient emotions too seriously? I'm not suggesting that we should ignore our emotions. That's a huge mistake. We all know that. No mature person ignores emotions. Emotions are part of our human reality, part of who we are. Fine. To ignore our emotions would definitely be a mistake. Maybe to take our emotions too seriously is also a mistake. Suppose the weather forecast is for occasional rain. Does it mean you cower inside your home, afraid to go out because it might rain? The rain comes, the rain goes. Let it come, let it go. Agama apai. It comes and goes. Well, just like clouds come and go, rains come and go, sadness comes and goes, grief comes and goes. When you lose a loved one, that incredible pain of loss, that grief, it comes, it goes. But sometimes in that moment of sadness and grief and suffering, we forget. We lose sight of the bigger picture. So this is what Sri Krishna is bringing Arjuna to. He says, Arjuna, come on. Look at the bigger picture. Yes, it's true that this is a horrible situation. On the battlefield, what could be a worse situation than what Arjuna finds? But that situation is, all those situations are anityaha. They are all transient. 18 days of battle will come to an end. Whatever difficulty you're going through will come to an end. Whatever sadness you're going through will come to an end. Any grief that you're experiencing will come to an end. Whatever you're feeling today, tomorrow it will be different. So the good news, of course, is if you're sad, don't worry, it'll change. Of course, on the other hand, if you're really happy, don't worry. That'll also change. This is the human condition. And it's good that we should laugh at this. We should laugh at ourselves. Our emotions are like that. Whatever our emotions are, they're coming, they're going. What can we do? Final observation before we move on. When that really dark cloud is hanging up in the sky, obscuring the sun still shines. We need to discover this. That even in the presence of that dark cloud, the sun is still shining. Even in the presence of the most deep sadness and grief, Atma shines within. We have to discover this. This is coming in some coming verses, but this is what's to be discovered. So a little bit, we're like little children. The big cloud comes and darkens the sky, and little children feel, oh, it's terrible. It's so dark. It's so gloomy. And the adult knows that those clouds will travel on, and in the same way, we can know whatever the sadness or grief, anxiety, whatever it is, it will all pass. Next verse.
Yam hi na vyathayantye te, yam hi na vyathayantye, purusham purusharshabha, purusham samadukha sukham dhiram, somratatvaya kalpate.
Ete na vyathayanti. Purusharshaba. He addresses Arjuna as Purusharshaba, a bull among men, mighty Arjuna, he says, Ete. These people, referring to the Dhira, the wise ones in the prior verse, Ete, these, na vyatayanti. These wise ones do not get disturbed. Na vyatayanti. They do not get disturbed. Yam. Sama dukkha, let's see, dhiram. Ete vyatayanti purusham. Key, because, okay, I'm just going to get oriented with the verse. One who is truly dhira is sama sukha dukham. One who is truly wise, dhira, is sama sukha dukha. Is the same, has equanimity towards sukha and dukkha, towards the happy situations of our lives and the unpleasant situations in lives. Why? Ete navyatayanti. These people do not get disturbed getting the big picture. We discussed so extensively in the previous verse. So when you stand away from that painting, you get the big picture. You see the beauty of the picture in spite of the cracks. Suppose you're in a really bad situation in your life. Very difficult, very painful. If you can stand back, metaphorically, from the situation of your life, if you can get the bigger picture of what's going on in your life, see where you'll be a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, get a bigger picture, or bigger picture with regard to the past. See all the wonderful things that have already come into your lives. The moment you get the bigger picture, you see the beauty. Those cracks in the painting do not detract from the beauty of the painting when you stand back and get the big picture. In the same way, the problems of your lives do not detract from the beauty of the of your life, but we must stand back to get that big picture. So, ete these, navyatiyanti yampurusham. Don't get disturbed. Why? Such a dhiram, such a wise person, is sama dukkha sukham. It has equanimity towards the happy and unpleasant situations in lives. And saha, that person, that wise person, amritatvaya kalpate. That wise person is fit, kalpate, is fit amritatvaya, for amritatvam, literally for immortality. Such a person is fit for immortality. Perhaps a very poetic expression. This person who has equanimity in the present moment, this person has freedom in his or her heart. They're no longer on that vicious roller coaster of life. This metaphor is sometimes used, comparing life to that roller coaster. And I don't know. What is the goal? Is the goal of life to be utterly unaffected by everything that goes on? Is that really our goal of life? To be hard like a rock? Nothing can affect us. This expression, sama dukkha sukham, can be misinterpreted in that way, so that nothing will affect you. You are impervious to any kind of emotion. Can that be the goal of life? To me, that's a little bit like the person who's afraid to take their car out of the garage. The car, and can I remind you, please, to make sure that all the cell phones are off during the class. Thank you. to me, the person who's afraid of having some emotion, who's afraid of some unpleasant situation or afraid of an unpleasant emotion, is a little bit like the person who's afraid to take the car out of the garage. It might get dented. It might get dirty. Something might happen to the car. Let's leave the car in the garage. Hey, what is the point? Or just to make a funny observation, you've seen this too. When you go to one of these shopping malls, have you noticed that in the far corner of the mall, there's one car parked there all alone? It's a brand new car, right? And this guy has parked it there in the far corner of the mall because he doesn't want anyone to dent his car or to come close to his car. So he parks it in a far corner. He has to hike a quarter of a mile to the store and then has to hike with his arms full of merchandise. He has to hike a quarter of a mile back. This is a kind of overprotectiveness with a car. That's silly. It's a burden. The car is going to get some dents. That's normal. It's okay. The car is going to get dirty. Okay, you can handle it. You wash the car. In the same way, in life, we are going to get some dents. Sometimes they're physical dents, that is, physical problems, illness, disease, etc. Sometimes they're emotional dents. Somebody will say or do something very hurtful. We can handle it. Your car with a couple of dents and a little dirt is okay. In the same way, our lives, even with our problems, physical problems, emotional problems, that's part of life. It's okay. But in order to say it's okay, you must have the bigger picture. Now, this leads us into the next part of the text. And I think we're just going to begin here. It's a very big topic. Because you can't fake it. Talking about equanimity or having the big picture. To be like the parrot saying, I am Satchidananda Atma, I'm independent of the body, mind, senses, all of this, it's not enough. In the last class, we made a very important observation that we're going to come back to right now. And that is, belief is not enough. Belief, shraddha, is not enough. It's important. Without question, shraddha is important, but it's not enough. Is it enough to... Would you say that you believe that you'll be okay if your car gets dented? Is that something you believe? Or is it something you know? This is a key distinction. Your independence of your automobile is something that you know in a very clear, objective way. If it were just belief, and I think we commented in our last class, beliefs can get shaky. And sadly, a belief can get shaky at the time that you need it most. I think in the last class we talked about how if you have a very sad situation, some people have a very simple belief in God, but unfortunately, sometimes in life, in a moment of crisis, sometimes their belief gets shaken, their belief in God. And this is so sad because at a time when they need their belief most, that belief gets shaky. This is a problem that we must address. Belief by nature is shaky. It's only belief. What we're after and what Sri Krishna is going to begin unfolding with this next verse is not belief but knowledge. You know that you're okay. Even if your car gets stolen, you'll manage. You're okay. To have that same kind of knowledge with regard to our physical bodies and more, to have a clear knowledge that whatever happens to the body, I'll be okay. Whatever happens to my emotions, I'll be okay. But not like the parrots, and not just as a matter of belief, but as a matter of personal discovery, knowledge, wisdom. And that's the title of this chapter, Sankhya Yoga. The title of chapter 2, Sankhya here means knowledge, means spiritual wisdom. And that spiritual wisdom is unfolded in the most brilliant way. In this is one of the really important verses of Bhagavad Gita. If you wanted to collect 10 or 20 of the most important verses of the Gita, this might be one of those 10 or 20. Let's begin.
Na sato vidyate bhavo.
Na sato vidyate bhavo.
Na bhavo vidyate sataha.
Ubhayorapi drishtontas.
Tvanayos tattva darshivihi.
This is so brilliant and clear.
Na asataha vidyate bhavaha.
Asataha. Asat, that which does not exist. Asataha. For that which does not exist, na vidyate bhava, it won't come into existence. There will not exist any existence, is being very literal. That which does not exist will not come into existence. The apple in my hand is never going to fulfill my hunger, because that which doesn't exist cannot come into existence. Okay, that's pretty obvious. That which does not exist will not come into existence, but on the other hand, na abhavaha vidyate sataha, sat, that which exists. Sataha, for that which exists, na vidyate, there will never be any abhava, any absence. I'll paraphrase that first line. That which doesn't exist will never come into existence. That which exists will never cease to be. Now, this verse is just introducing a very important sequence of verses that we'll continue much more in the next class, in which we focus on Atma, the true self, as that which is avinashi, indestructible. And the approach, it's almost like science. Remember in a science class, learning certain principles. One was the conservation of matter, conservation of energy, conservation of momentum. These three I remember. So physical principles, conservation of matter and energy, that which exists can change form, but it doesn't become non-existent. When you burn a piece of wood, does anything truly cease to exist? That wood is converted into other forms of matter and energy. That wood is converted into smoke and ash, which is matter, and converted into heat and light, which is energy. But if you add up the heat and light and the ash and the smoke, it equals exactly the piece of wood you started with. That wood exists. That which exists can never cease to exist. This is true in science. This is exactly what Sri Krishna is beginning with in teaching Arjuna about the true nature of oneself. That which exists will never cease to be. The core of your being, and this will only be an introduction. We have to come, this is a big verse, we have to come back here when we meet next week. But when we meet next week, this is going to be our beginning point, just to give you something to reflect on through the week. You, the indweller of the body, we're going to understand as consciousness. This is next week's class, but just to give you a sneak preview, I think they call it. in the movie theater, they call it a trailer. Why do they call them trailers? To trail means to follow, right? But they put the trailers on before the movie? Sorry. This is our sneak preview. What we're going to see is this. The consciousness which is you, the consciousness present in this experience, you, the conscious person, indwelling this body, you, the conscious person, looking out through these little holes, you, the conscious person, hearing whatever comes in these holes, smelling whatever comes in these holes, tasting whatever comes in these holes, you, the conscious person, abiding within. Does this conscious person exist or not? Of course. It's the focal point of your experience. Sataha, for this conscious being within, na vidyate abhavaha, there can never be a condition of non-existence. So, what Arjuna is going to be told in the next series of verses is about the true self is a self that can never be destroyed, avinashi. So this is where we will pick up the thread when we meet next Saturday. A couple of quick announcements at the end of today's class. Let me just turn off this recording.